Welcome to the Security Analysis Podcast. This podcast explores investment strategies, economics, personal finance, and stock analysis. It features real conversations and analysis to inform, educate, and entertain. Note that nothing in this podcast is investment advice, and it is for entertainment and discussion purposes only. Do your own due diligence before making any investment. Now, on to the show.
Today's episode is derived from questions that I've received via email and via Twitter. I'm also going to talk briefly about an article I wrote recently. If you have any questions that you would like featured on one of these episodes, email me at valuestockgeek@substack.com, and I'll gladly answer your question in the next podcast. Just a reminder, the podcast is completely user-supported. I don't run any ads. If you want to support it, consider a subscription at securityanalysis.org. Subscribers get early access to my podcast episodes. Usually they're behind a paywall for 2 weeks and then they go wide. I also research a company every single week and publish a write-up about it. Additionally, I post about everything I'm doing in my portfolio with total transparency. If you don't want to subscribe, please consider leaving a review at your podcast provider of choice, whether it's Apple or Google or Overcast or whatever it is. That definitely helps the program. So now on to today's episode. First off, the article I mentioned is about David Einhorn's recent proclamation that markets are broken due to a passive bubble. I'll link to my article in the show notes. Long story short, I disagree with him. I'm not going to repeat the entire article. You can go read it, but here's my basic argument. First, based on my own observations, I think that the behavior of most stocks out there makes sense when you look at over the long run and you look under the hood at the performance of the company. My Substack, the exercise of going through a company every single week and evaluating its business and historical performance, has basically taught me that Ben Graham is right. Markets are indeed a short-term voting machine, a long-term weighing machine, just like he said. Over the long run, if you hold a stock for 10 or 20 years, it's pretty much going to be driven by the performance of the business. Not passive flows, not the Fed, not whatever boogeyman active managers have decided to pick on, but pretty much you eat your own cooking. Like, if you make a bet on a stock, you're going to ultimately get the performance of the business, assuming you pay a reasonable price. I think that the idea that markets are broken is completely wrong. Graham's framework is correct. Every week, I look at a new company. And whenever I look at the company's results over 20 years, you can boil down the performance to the performance of the business, growth in fundamentals, dividends, buybacks. Valuation plays a role, but it's not nearly as important over long time frames, assuming that you're paying a reasonable price for a company. If you hold it for long enough, you'll basically get the performance of that business over a long time frame. And even changes in valuation, changes in multiples, are usually rooted in fundamental reasons. Like, a business doesn't go from a 10 price to sales ratio to a 3 price to sales ratio for no reason. Usually there is some type of underlying business reason that occurs. Second, Einhorn argues that he's looking for situations which are basically guaranteed money. So his argument is that this passive bubble is so pervasive, markets are basically broken. So you need to identify situations where you basically can't lose. So he cites situations where he picks up stocks at a PE of 5 that are buying back 20% of their stocks. Now, that's a situation that ought to work no matter what is happening in the larger market. That is basically guaranteed money. Problem is, if you run screeners looking for these things, you'll see that there aren't a lot out there. If you do come across them, there's probably some massive risk. They're selling a lot of their businesses in China. They're in a very cyclical industry that looks like it's at some type of cyclical peak. And if you can identify the risk, trust me, based on experience, it will eventually become apparent to you what that risk is once you lose a bunch of money in the stock. Basically, in my experience, markets don't just give away free money, which suggests to me that there are still active managers and people out there doing security analysis to identify these situations and pick them up. If markets were actually broken, like Einhorn says, meaning no one is doing security analysis and all the price action in the market is basically determined by passive flows, there would be a lot of situations outside of the indexes that you could make money on. There would be situations where there's perfectly stable companies with at a PE of 5 that are buying back 20% of their stock every year, and you're not going to find a lot of them. And if you look through Einhorn's current portfolio, he doesn't own any of them either. So I'm not really sure what he's talking about there. He did own a situation that was kind of like that a few years ago in Dillard stock that was around like a PE of 6 and they were buying back a lot of stock. But at the moment, I looked through his portfolio on Datarama and I can't really find anything that's like what he's describing. The other way that you could basically bank profits based on this passive bubble is a real easy arbitrage situation. You could just buy stocks right before they enter the index. Passive flows would pump them up, and then you'd be able to sell for a guaranteed profit. The problem is that index effect doesn't exist anymore. The research shows that it worked way better back in the 1990s, and that effect is getting reduced. So if there were truly a passive bubble, I would expect that phenomenon to intensify. Instead, it's getting arbitraged away, because that's what happens in markets. There are lots of people out there trying to identify situations where they can make guaranteed profits. And if that exists, they're going to scoop it up. I just don't buy that there's a situation where there are so many investors that have gone passive that there's no one out there to set prices or do research or try to make money in the market. The other point I make in the article is that passive simply isn't big enough. Passive funds account for over 50% of U.S. equity funds, but that's only among U.S. equity funds. If you break down the total ownership of the market, who actually owns the shares? Passive funds account for only 17% of the market. Now, the naysayers might say that, well, those business owners and households, they're not actually involved in the buying and selling every day. But so what? I mean, they're still out there. They can still sell their shares. They're still actively involved in the market. They might not be hyperactive and in there every day like a U.S. equity fund is. But if you break down the total ownership of the market, there should still be plenty of active investors that could actually set prices. I also make the point in the article that passive investors aren't really passive. So what do I mean by that? Lots of investors will go out there and quote Jeff Bogle, and they'll say buy and hold, and I'm going to stay in the market forever. But most investors don't actually do that. They don't just buy a U.S. index fund and keep it there for 20 years. That's kind of a rare breed of person. Most people dart in and out of the market based on how they're feeling about things. And that typically means poor market timing. They sell at market lows, they get bulled up at market highs, and that's not truly passive. People are adjusting their allocations based on conditions, and they're often getting it wrong. And that is an active investing choice. I'd also say just use your own damn eyes. Like, does it look to you like people are truly buy and hold, never worry about the market? They never try to pick stocks. They never try to pick managers. After the last few years where we've seen like the meme stock mania and you've seen bubbles get inflated and driven away, does it seem like active management is dead? Does it seem like no one is out there actually analyzing stocks? I just don't see it. I mean, look at the volatility that you see in some of the large cap stocks. If this passive bubble theory were true, these large cap stocks would all just go up no matter what, regardless of how the business is doing. Would you have a situation where Meta gets down to like 8x earnings in 2022? That shouldn't exist in this passive bubble scenario. Personally, I think this is cope. I think it's the latest version of blaming the Fed for everything. Kind of a staple of underperforming managers is that they'll blame their bad performance in the Federal Reserve. Like, I wasn't wrong about these stocks, but the Fed screwed me, is generally the argument. Now they have a new scapegoat, the passive bubble, and I just don't think it's true. And even if it was, it still wouldn't change my investing approach. Like, I want to find companies that are at attractive valuations. I want to find good companies. And whether there's a passive bubble or not, I don't see how that would change. And frankly, I don't see how any active manager strategy should change. Like, ultimately, you are trying to find value in the market, whether it's by trying to identify growth situations or trying to identify value situations that are out of favor in the market. You're trying to identify mispricings. Enough people out there trying to identify mispricings where markets can set prices over the long run. And when you look under the hood and you look at individual companies, you'll pretty much see that that's true over the long run. There is almost always some kind of fundamental explanation when you look at a stock that has done well. There's also usually an explanation when a stock has done poorly. I just don't see this phenomena where money is mindlessly flowing into the biggest stocks in the market, and that's the only reason they're going up. Like, the biggest stocks in the market are the biggest stocks in the market because they're performing so well, because the businesses are executing so well. And that's pretty much my take on it. Okay, so next question. I'm in my 40s and I haven't started saving for retirement yet. Is it too late? What should I do at this point? So this is a good question. So the personal finance blogosphere, they tend to target freaks, people who are really serious about saving, who save tons of money, who do things like pursue financial independence, retire early. But these people are highly unusual. When you're listening to them, I could understand how it's easy for someone to get discouraged if they're not like that, and they must think that they're way far behind. So these people, I would say, keep in mind that the median net worth of a 65-year-old is $400,000. And within that $400,000 figure, a bulk of that is home equity. So that means that basically most of these people, they have a home that's paid off, but they're pretty much living off of Social Security. So if you haven't reached $1 million by 40, you absolutely should not get discouraged. That is a very unusual thing to happen. And like, why does this happen? I mean, saving money is hard. Employment often isn't consistent. Most people don't stay in the same job for 40 years and never have any disruption in their employment. Expenses are high. Life happens. You know, no one that actually becomes a millionaire gets there by accident, unless you're talking about lottery winners or something. But for the most part, it's something that you achieve by being super conscious of, but you're monitoring your spending, you're making sure you're saving, you're investing correctly. It's a hard thing to pull off. I'd argue it's one of the hardest things a person can do. I mean, there are a lot of people who are out there and they say it's like running a marathon, but it's harder than that. A marathon can be trained for over a few months. It's over in a day. This is the kind of thing you need to keep up and stick to for decades. It's extremely hard. It's one of the hardest things you'll ever do. And it comes down to a combination of executing in your career. It comes down to being able to live way below your means. It comes down to being able to resist the pull of lifestyle inflation. Like, these are all very hard things to do. So if you haven't done it, or you are envious of people who have done it, like, don't get too discouraged. Like, it's something that's a hard thing to pull off. I'd also add, just look at the average, the median American. The median American has about $6,000 in credit card debt, about $8,000 in savings. Like, the average American is not some fire millionaire that you're listening to on a podcast. So, I mean, the first thing I'd say is don't beat yourself up. I'll bet you're doing way better than you imagine you're doing, particularly if you spend a lot of time consuming personal finance content on the internet, which is mostly geared, as I mentioned earlier, towards these freaks of nature who are really hardcore about this stuff. So anyway, back to the question, you still have plenty of time. If you're 40, traditional retirement is 25 years away. If you're 45, it's 20 years away. That is plenty of time to build up a big portfolio and have a nice nest egg for retirement. It's 100% possible. Let me put it for you in these terms. If you were 40 in 2004 and you invested $1,000 a month back into the market, today you'd have over $1 million at the age of 60. So that's a plenty. Like, that's plenty of money. Your portfolio is going to throw off about 40 grand a year using the 4% rule. You probably have a paid off home at that point if you've been that disciplined with your savings. And on top of that, you're going to probably get some Social Security. So in my opinion, that's plenty to retire. You have a paid off home, you have an income coming in from your portfolio, you have a nice cushion. On top of that, you'll get some Social Security. And that's way ahead of where most 65-year-olds are. Most 65-year-olds are not millionaires. So you have plenty of time to start saving and investing aggressively. I'd say consistency is key through the ups and downs of the market. Just keep investing, just stick to the program. If you're concerned about things like asset allocation and stock selection, if you haven't actually started, it doesn't really matter too much, like, what specific strategy you're pursuing. Like, you'll have plenty of time to learn about these things and adjust your portfolio as time goes by. Right now, just focus on starting. Start to invest. You know, a good foundational asset to look at would be an ETF like VT that gives you ownership of all the stocks in the world. VTI is the total US market. Something like that is kind of a good base to start a portfolio off with. Over time, you could add things to that. You could diversify it a bit more as you approach retirement. But right now, just get started. Just get going. And don't beat yourself up over it. You know, there's nothing to be gained by looking back at the past, but beating yourself up for things you did in the past. Learn from it and move on and make the most that you can for the future. Next question. Any change in stance on PayPal? So I'm holding on to PayPal. I've owned it for a couple of years at this point. I considered selling it at the end of the year review that I did this year. I'm currently down over 30% from my purchase price. Looking at it again, the valuation is much more compelling since I bought it. I bought it around 20 times enterprise multiple. Right now it's down to 11 times. So it's down significantly from the peak back in 2020, where it reached 65 times. Meanwhile, if you look at the financials, the company continues to perform pretty well. Top line still growing. Revenues have gone from $17 billion in 2019 to $29 billion today. Like a lot of stocks, this is a business that had an insane ramp up during the pandemic. It's moderated a bit. And with that, you've had a wild swing in valuation where they've gone from being insanely overvalued at the peak of the pandemic after the big swing upward in the business. Then they were punished as the business moderated a bit. But if you kind of zoom out and look at it, the business has basically grown normally over that period. It just had this insane ramp in the middle that kind of screwed up people's expectations and led to this euphoria and then despair later on. You look at the business operating margins went from 15.7% in 2019. They're 16.6% now. And meanwhile, payment volumes, if you look at investor presentations from PayPal, they continue to process more transactions at higher dollar volume. So it looks to me like the business is fine. I think the narrative about PayPal is that it's in secular decline because there's other alternatives that are coming up with electronic payments. But I think most of that narrative is just driven by the stock price and all of the oddball comments that you've had from management recently. You know, if you take a step back and you look at the valuation and you look at the business, it still seems like a good investment to me today. And my point of view is basically that electronic payments are a big tent. There's room for lots of different options. PayPal is just one of those companies. This isn't going to be a winner-take-all situation where, like, for Apple Pay to succeed, they have to eat into PayPal's business. Like, electronic payments are still a growing market, and there's room for lots of different companies in there. All that said, I could be wrong. That's why I don't put 40% of my portfolio into a situation like PayPal. I'm going to continue to monitor it. If I see evidence that the market is right, like the actual business starts to decline, then I would consider selling it. But that said, I don't see anything like that right now. So I'm going to continue to hold it, give the position more time to work, especially from current valuations. At 11 times, I think the stock is pretty compelling versus where it's typically traded in the past. Next question. Do you think a recession is coming in the next few years? So I always operate like a recession can happen tomorrow. When I was more into macro, I got really obsessed with trying to predict recessions. You'd look at things like, is the yield curve inverted? You could look at the total indebtedness of household balance sheets. That worked well to predict the 2008 crisis. You could look at something like the VIX, like when the VIX is very low and things are really tranquil, it's usually a sign that things are about to get bad. So I tried all of that. I looked at all of these things, trying to find some way to predict recessions. And now I basically think it's all nonsense. None of it actually works. You can't predict recessions. If you could, you'd be a billionaire. So accepting the fact that I can't predict recessions, I opted to simply construct portfolios that can survive recessions. When I was more deep value oriented, I would own a lot of very cyclical situations. I think like steel companies and oil companies and mall retailers. But the problem was those are things are really hard to hold if a recession pops up tomorrow. Those things can have massive drawdowns. And because I think recessions can pop up out of nowhere and are completely unpredictable, I only own companies that I'm confident can survive them. And for my asset allocation, I own an asset allocation with some protections for recessions just because I am worried and I think that they can pop up at any time. The alternative assets there are long-term treasuries, gold. I also personally stay out of debt and I maintain a sizable emergency fund, which also adds a buffer of safety if a recession arrives. So I found that kind of approach, having a portfolio and a lifestyle that is prepared for a recession, is better than trying to predict a recession, which I've concluded is basically impossible. Next question, how do you track total return performance? So tracking my performance is pretty easy. My stock picking account is an IRA that I have specifically set aside from everything else for the sole purpose of picking stocks and deploying my stock picking strategy. So as a result, there isn't really any money coming into it or out of it. So tracking that performance is really easy. I just compare the balances at the start and end for the period, and I know how the portfolio did. I use Schwab as a broker, and they have some nice tools and visualizations that make it easy to track how the portfolio is performing. Last year in my year-end review, I posted a screenshot of a chart to show my performance, to show that, hey, what I'm showing you guys on the blog is what's actually happening in my portfolio. You know, overall, I think short-term performance is a lot of noise. With that said, I've been pleased with my strategy over the last few years. I started my new process a few years ago. I started the Substack in 2021 to analyze quality companies, identify them, define an investable universe. And I actually started to buy these companies in 2022. And since then, the results have been pretty good. In 2022, I lost 13.5%. And the S&P was down more than that. I was down 18%. Last year, I slightly beat the S&P 500. I was up 27%. The S&P was up 26%. So, and that was in a year when equal weighting and most other strategies did pretty poorly. So I think that's pretty good for a concentrated portfolio of 12 to 15 stocks. And I'm pretty happy with that. On my Substack, I'm completely transparent about what I'm buying, selling, holding, and I'm measuring my real results and I'm posting them on the newsletter. I'm not a financial writer who writes a bunch of content and never tells you how these ideas did, how I'm positioning those ideas. and how it's all coming together. I'm committed to total transparency on that blog. This is a real money account and I'm writing about what I'm doing with it, warts and all. So I hope you're enjoying that ride. And a bit of a tangent, but that's basically what I do. I can measure the performance because it's an isolated account. I get some good tools from Schwab. Next question. I've heard you mention before that you were in a lot of debt. What are the details about it and how'd you get out of it? Good question. I did accumulate a lot of debt in my 20s. I believe I had a bad attitude about money. I looked at money as basically a tool for fun. I also had an attitude that I could always increase my income and get out of it. Those are some very toxic attitudes that will result in some big money missteps. Then 2008 basically came along. At that point, I was 26. It rocked my world for many reasons. First, I was very much aware that the economy was in free fall, and I was aware that I could easily lose my job at any time, and I wouldn't easily be able to replace it. At the time, I had a lot of debt. I had little savings. I had just started my career, and I was essentially living paycheck to paycheck. And my main hope was that my income would go up in the future, and that would help me get out of the debt and the hole that I was in. And it was starting to dawn on me by the middle of 2008 that counting on a bigger paycheck in the future wasn't much of a strategy. Then things got even worse as 2008 continued to roll along and the credit crisis continued to get worse. My credit card companies, they jacked up my interest rates. They cut my limits. That had the bad effect of increasing my utilization rate. And then my credit score started to go down, which caused my rates to go up even more. And, you know, I was a finance guy. I majored in finance in college. I was taught, you know, debt is a tool and all that nonsense. And I was kind of learning the hard way that Dave Ramsey is basically right. The borrower is slave to the lender. I also had a bunch of middle-aged coworkers, and I saw they were in a really bad situation. And in looking at them, I saw where I was headed. They had a lot of debt. They had mortgages they could only afford if they kept their jobs. They were living paycheck to paycheck. They were in intense anxiety because they were worried about losing their jobs in 2008. And I really saw that future and it scared me. And I was like, I don't want to wind up like that when I'm a middle-aged person. I'd also add a major component of my debt at this point was an alcohol problem. So it actually cost me an earlier job. I was a big drinker in my 20s. I could easily spend $200 a week between booze and going out to bars with my friends. I was in bad shape at 26 in 2008. And once it all started to dawn on me, the situation that I was in, I was pretty terrified. Step one for me was to just first stop digging the hole. A big part of that was quitting drinking. I haven't had a drink since 2008, since I did all this. And I stopped going out. Going out in my mid-20s was a major expense, and I just basically stopped all of it. I bought in a bunch of cash. I sold most of my possessions on eBay. In terms of the specific strategy, I followed Dave Ramsey's debt snowball method to get out of debt. Now, this is often criticized because mathematically, you should probably target your higher interest rates first. The debt snowball is different because you're listing your debts from smallest to largest and you're attacking the smallest ones first. I found the snowball was very helpful. It gave me like psychological momentum where you see all these little quick wins and that gets you moving. It also frees up cash flow fast. So you're making minimum payments on all of these smaller debts and that ties up cash flow in your budget. So when you're freeing up that cash flow, you're freeing up whatever you are putting towards that minimum in your budget. And you can now put that towards other debt. So as you're getting out of these debts, your fixed costs falling fast and you can breathe a little bit easier because there's a bigger gulf between your income and your expenses. So that's why that really helped me. And I mean, there's a lot of discussions between which is better, the snowball or the avalanche. Both of them work. Key thing is like, you don't keep that debt lingering around. Like your target should be to get out of this in a few years. It's not the type of thing where you're paying off debt over 20 years, in which case something like the avalanche versus snowball makes a huge difference in terms of how you're attacking this. It should be a quick thing. It should be something where you're putting all your energy and all of your effort to get out of it. I also moved into a very cheap place. It was very, very cheap with minimal costs. I limited my food budget to $25 a week. Another major step was I cut up all my credit cards and I stopped using them. Like, that's what I mean by stop digging the hole. Like, you need to change your mindset where if you don't have the money, you're not going to buy it. It's not, debt really accumulates when you start to get the attitude, well, I'll just pay for that from my next paycheck. Like, if you remove that as an option, you will be more disciplined. you say, like, if I don't have the money, I'm not buying it, you'll be in much better shape. And, you know, the experience was rough. I mean, back then my job was rough. I had a difficult boss. My company made a lot of unreasonable demands. It was the kind of thing where I'd be there till 10 o'clock every night. And I wasn't doing it to advance my career. I was doing it to just not get fired. And it completely sucked. And my employer had me by the throat. They knew it. And they knew, what was I going to do? There are no other jobs out there, and they could do pretty much whatever they wanted to me. In terms of amounts, my debt back then was basically equal to 100% of my after-tax salary. It took, in total, I wish I kept better records of it, but I believe it took about 2.5 years to get out of it. And the whole thing took extreme discipline, but it taught me some real important lessons about life. Like, chief among them is the realization that I never wanted to be in that situation again. I never wanted to be in a situation where my employer had me by the throat like that, where I had such an uncertain environment to deal with. And debt is just uncertainty and anxiety and stress. And it's not something you want to, it's not the way you want to live. I'd say the biggest thing I got out of that was just the appropriate way to deal with money. I'm glad I went through that. Like, I had a bad attitude about money, and it took that experience to kind of change that attitude. If I had some kind of windfall that took me out of all of my debt at 26, I probably would have just gotten back into debt again, because it took no discipline to get out of it. I needed that kick in the butt. I needed to get that discipline, and I needed that total mindset shift. And that experience gave me the mindset shift that allowed me to start accumulating pretty aggressively. And after that, I basically applied the same methods and the same attitudes and kept my expenses very low and focused on making more money. And that helped me start to accumulate the money I am investing today. And I'm glad that all happened to me. If you are in debt, I just say, you know, think about my experience. There is a way to get out of it. There is a plan. There is hope, but it's going to take hard work, and it's going to take a lot of discipline to do it. Next question. If you had to pick an ETF or a fund for maximum performance over 30 years, I'm talking about microcaps, growth, specific sectors or industries, but it has to have at least a 10 to 20 year track record, what would that be? Okay, so the 10 to 20 year track record, that's a major hurdle with this question. There are a lot of cool funds that are out there, but many of them have been launched relatively recently. That said, with the length of time taken into consideration, there is one I'd pick. The first is the ETF SLYV, S-L-Y-V. The Vanguard version of that is V-I-O-V, but SLYV has the longer track record, kind of meeting your definition here. And that goes back to 2000. So SLYV is the index fund that represents the S&P 600 small cap value index. So what is that? That's an index fund based on the small cap value index with defined rules. That fund also has a pretty low expense ratio of 0.15%. I believe VIOV is around the same. I like the way that that particular index is constructed. Unlike the Russell 2000 small cap index, the S&P 600 is a small cap index with a quality filter to it. So the most important quality filter in the S&P 600 is a requirement that the company made money in the last year. So over the last four quarters, the company needs to be earning positively. So that keeps a lot of the money losing garbage outside of the index. The S&P also considers liquidity, how much float is available, and they look into the financial viability of the company. So the Russell doesn't reflect any of that. The Russell is simply whether the company is publicly traded and what's its current market cap. That's basically how the Russell is constructed. So the S&P 600 is within a larger index, the S&P 1500, and that's split up into the 500, which is the large caps, the 400, which is a mid caps, and then the 600 is small caps. And they're actively selecting which companies enter these particular index funds. That's often presented as a bad thing by critics, like, oh, the S&P is just selected by a committee. But I actually like it. They keep the only companies in that index are companies that are profitable. And if you don't remain profitable, you get kicked out of the index. So within that S&P 600 value index, you're talking about a universe of 600 profitable small caps, which you cannot say about the Russell 2000. There are a lot of money losing companies within the Russell. And then they basically cut that universe in half and buy the cheapest half of that universe. My understanding is they use a composite value measure, price to book, price to earnings, price to cash flow. Like, they're using multiple metrics to define what the cheapest half of that universe is. And if you plug SLYV into Portfolio Visualizer, that index has returned 9.6% since 2000. So that beats the returns of the S&P 500 over the same period, which only delivered an 8% CAGR. And just little note there. That's because of the starting date. So 2000 is a great starting point for any value strategy. But with that said, Slivy does wind up beating most active value stock pickers. You will not find many value managers who have earned 9.6% for 24 years. So I'd say that the small cap value index ETF is by far the way to go. On top of that, Slivy is very tax efficient because it's an ETF and it's in that ETF structure, which is a tax advantage structure. So that's my pick, Slivy. If I could consider funds with a shorter track record, I'd probably go for the Avantis funds. AVUV and AVDV are their US small cap value fund and international small cap value fund, respectively. I think they are even better constructed than the Slivy fund. Additionally, the US Small Cap Value Fund has actually beaten Slivy since 2020. Very short time frame, but I do think it says something about the quality of the Avantis funds and methodology. And I own some of AVDV and AVUV in my personal portfolio. So that's it for today. Thank you for the questions. I definitely want to do more of these episodes. And if you have questions, please email me at valuestockgeek@substack.com. And thank you for your time and listening to this episode today. Thanks.
Thank you for listening to today's podcast. For more information, please go to securityanalysis.org. Subscribers to the website get early ad-free access to podcast episodes in addition to weekly in-depth profiles of companies.